Go.
Okay. How are you? Hi guys.
Hey. I was just sending you whatever pictures I can find on the cloud.
We're at the home of introduce yourselves. What's your name?
What, we on now?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I'm Cecil Washington. This is my wife Audrey Washington.
Yes, I'm Cecil's wife.
And I'm Audrey's husband.
And we're sitting in front of your house, and can you tell us where you live?
We live in Maryland.
Where?
What part? Upper Marlboro. Okay.
How long have you lived in Upper Marlboro?
About 11 years.
11 years,
yeah.
Precisely. On April the 9th would have been 11 years.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about this house? Looks like your dream house.
Yeah, it's her dream house.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, well, the house was built. We had it built in April of 2010, so that's when it was completed, and it was a dream to move to this house and this location.
Do you remember why?
Originally I moved here to be nearer to my mother, and my mom passed, but I still wanted to be in Upper Marlboro because I wanted to be closer to the majority of our family, except Camila lives in Silver Spring, so that was the only bad part. But we did get closer to all our other relatives. So.
It's right in the middle of both sets of family, too.
It actually is.
Further south.
Yeah. And where's your family from, Cecil?
Most of my people are in southern Maryland. We got a few in southeast D.C. also, but mostly southern Maryland or southern P.G. County, Charles County.
Mm-hmm.
We got some relatives. I got my brother in Virginia. So right along there, right along the Potomac. Side of Maryland.
Yeah, so this is kind of a perfect location for both families. I do have family in New York, but this location in Maryland is close to my husband's family and to my family, my mother's side of family, Bryce, and I have some Winters on my father's side also living in this area in Maryland.
Yeah.
What is your background, Audrey, first?
Well, I am African American, but I'm Caribbean descent. My father is Jamaican, and my mother is Panamanian. And they met in New York and fell in love, got married, and had three children. So, yeah, so that's my background.
And Cecil, your family?
My family is pretty much local. We're African American. According to my ancestry DNA test results, I am a lot of stuff. I mean, a lot of stuff from the western part of Africa. Tiny percentage in India and Bangladesh and Europe. We were rumored to have Native American ancestry. But depending on which conspiracy theories you want to follow, it is proven or not proven by the DNA. So it's all going to depend upon how you look at it.
How long is your family? Your family's last name is?
Okay, my closest relative's family's last name is Washington, but my grandmother was a Ford, so we're the Washington Ford or Ford Washingtons. Her mother's maiden name was a Jenkins, so that group of the family is Ford Jenkins. On my father's side, they're all, as far as I know, Washingtons, but I think we're also kin to some of the Johnsons. And I think Newmans and Butlers.
Butlers?
Butlers. There are some relatives that are also Butlers, but they're not too closely tied in with us.
How long has your family been in this region?
At least four generations that I can verify, probably longer than that. I think my family's been around here ever since there's been a here to be around. The earliest story I have of where our family came from is, quote unquote, someone came up from the south to this region and populated people. The furthest back I could trace people on my mother's side that I know of is the Cobb Island. We have a branch of relatives there, but I've lost touch with those. My grandmother just stopped keeping in touch with them. She never went into why. She just did.
Can you tell them the Piscataway story? The family lore that you knew originally about Cobb Island?
Well, the family lore is that our great-grandmother Antoinette Ford was actually one quarter Piscataway, and we have some small lineage that traces in from there. But everybody else is pretty much like sharecropping on my mother's side. But on my father's side, I'm not sure, but it sounds like they may have been free black people, because apparently they owned some land. Some of my relatives, they're a little bit more distant to me, but I relate to my father's side, they still have some land that they own.
In Cobb Island or in Southern Maryland?
No, his, especially because I'm thinking about his, is in Southern Maryland. I do know we have relatives at Cobb Island. I just don't know them anymore because I've lost touch.
Can you talk about sharecropping a little bit? What you know about what sharecropping is?
From what I know, what sharecropping was is, if my understanding is correct, it kind of happened like a little bit after slavery. Some of the people who were now freedmen were allowed to stay on the slave owner's property and continue to farm the land, and they would get a percentage of the crops every year as profit, but they'd have to turn in the bulk of the, they would harvest their own crops, and they have to basically give like a tithe or a payment to the person that actually owned the land. And I know my grandparents did that for a long time before they eventually, they said my grandfather at one point was had a business where he was renting horses to people.
Can you talk about that?
Well, all I know is they say he used to be the guy that you could go to get a horse, and he was renting out horses to people for a fee. After that, he went into some other entrepreneurial activities. And eventually he stopped doing that, and he actually ended up getting a job as a custodian at the church. And my grandmother ended up being a maid at the church, at St. Mary's Piscataway. And so by the time I came along, we were all raised Catholic and raised up in the church.
Other Washington, when we went there, the Washingtons had a cemetery there, so it must have been older than him, right? Who were those Washingtons in the cemetery?
See, that's the thing. I don't really know them. I don't know who they were. I believe that may have been his mother, my grandfather's mother. I think he's one of six. And there are, so there's five other brothers of his whose descendants that I don't really know that well. He was also married before he married my grandmother. I think he was married twice. He didn't have children by the first one. The second wife, I don't know her name, but we did, because we used to go visit Aunt Emma. That was his daughter. So I know Aunt Emma, and I got cousins that I haven't seen them too much since we were kids, except for my cousin Cliff. And I see them at family reunions.
When we were interviewing you, tell them about how you think growing up in an agricultural family helped you develop your work ethic.
Oh, okay. A lot of stuff that people say, especially if you want to talk about like stuff that you may see in the Bible, it's sounds like a nice pretty metaphor of when you plant a seed at the right time, it will harvest. You know, the land will give you whatever you yield, you reap what you sow. By growing up as the last bit of people who has some exposure to farming, it's actually literal for me. I actually can know that because my cousin, they call him Fox, Rodarth Dyson. I'm also related to the Dysons on my father's side. He made us all plant little gardens. So he showed me, he literally took me out by his house. We planted some seeds for, I think it was tomatoes. We planted them at the right time. And then we planted some tomatoes at the wrong time. And we waited, which felt like an eternity for a child, but was probably no more than maybe 6 months tops. I could literally see what happens when a seed is planted at the right time in good soil, that it bloomed, that it blossomed, and it had other seeds. And then I saw literally what happened when you plant a seed at the wrong time. It tried to grow up in the winter and it died because it wasn't planted properly. All those principles about sowing and reaping, how you have to start things at the right time, getting up early, early to bed, early to rise, all those type of actions are literal, and I got to actually see them. if you've got somebody that you're telling things that even growing up in a suburb or some kind of detached from what you're calling an agricultural environment, it's abstract to them. It's not literal. It's just chosen or very literal. I learned that you have to do things in a particular season literally, or it's probably not going to work out for you. Another thing he used to tell me, this was my favorite Zen cone from him. See if I can get it right. He had a whole bunch of acorns in the front of his yard. And he pointed one of them. He said, "You see that acorn?" It's like, "Yeah." And you see, there was a big, he had a big oak tree. It's cut down now, but it was a big oak tree. So you see that tree? That big oak tree was inside of that acorn. The thing is, that tree was inside that acorn the whole time. The acorn just didn't know it yet. Now, look, see, so look over there at those, you see those acorns that's just running off what they want to do out here in the dirt? Those acorns out there playing in the dirt road. They're not landing on good soil, so they're not going to grow up right. But you see those that are growing over here in the rich grass? Those are going to become more trees. They're going to have acorns. They're going to have trees, and then they're going to have their more, they're going to have seeds. So you got to mind what ground you fall on. I'm just like, what? I'm like five. What are you talking about? What are you talking about? But it was literal. I could see, oh, so if something is not in the right environment, an organism is not in the right environment, it's going to decay. It's not going to grow up properly if it's in the wrong environment. And if it's in the right environment, it stands a good chance of growing up to do something productive, to grow. And I remember, it's funny that you mentioned that, because I remember when I was in college, I was talking to a guy, we were talking about where we grew up. His name is Ed Reed. He's a motivational speaker now. That's a whole nother story. I feel like Ed saved my college career because he kept me from doing something stupid. I told him about that, and I said, I also, in addition to seeing the acorn inside of the tree, I also realized that inside that acorn was an orchard.
What?
Orchard, not just the tree. So sometimes you have to think about something small. You don't really understand the significance of it when you look at something that's small. All you can see is just the little tiny thing, how small it is. You don't really understand how it's going to grow into something big. And that means an acorn can become an orchard, can become an entire forest. Matter of fact, there's a tree in California on the West Coast. That forest is actually one gigantic organism.
I went there.
Yeah. I've never been there. I saw that on some nature show. But that's how sometimes you really don't understand the significance of an idea, because you're just a little acorn. And all you see is what you've got in front of you. But that was a life lesson that I've taken with me.
Tell them also about the getting in back of your, I think it was your uncle, with the truck, what it meant to start working early, how that impacted you.
Oh. Well, one thing, because he had a trash truck.
What's his name?
Uncle Bernard. Bernard Wash. He had a trash hauling business that he did on the side. And I'm one of four, so all four of us have had to do time on a trash truck. All four of us had to do time helping him clean up the church when he took over the custodian duties at the church. I don't know if all four of us dug graves. I don't know if they made the girls dig graves or not. But I know at least my brother and I had to help him dig graves at the church. So on Saturday mornings, I had to get up right at the crack of dawn, go with him. There was barely any room in that truck. I'd end up sitting like this with my feet up. He had all kinds of batteries, magazines, and mechanical stuff inside the truck. We were going around hauling the trash for most of the day. So, I mean, I was no stranger to getting up early in order to do something. And that was my first job. I made $20 a day. That was the first boss I negotiated a pay raise with. So I think he bumped me up to $25 a day.
What did you learn from these work experiences?
I watched him negotiate with people. I saw what happens when people are late with their bills, how they try to hem and haw. I learned how to just deal with people. He never let anybody rile him up. And especially when you're picking up trash from people, like, anything could happen. Dogs would come after us. Strange people would come after us. I mean, just just life's weird randomness, because I saw him handle it, I learned how to handle it. And I think it gave me the idea of you can have more than one stream of income.
Talk about the block where your family lived. What's now Friendly Lane.
Yeah, Friendly Oak Place or something.
Friendly Oak Place.
But back then, it was only a few houses. It was a little cul-de-sac, totally surrounded by trees. All those nice houses you see back there now were not there. It's basically like a little pocket in the woods with one dirt road that fed down the side of it. And I had, it was my grandmother's house here. Cousin Rodak's house here, across from it. And at that time, my uncle didn't live in a house that's built back there. He had a trailer that he had there, and he was building the house. He was building it himself. His dream was to eventually build that house himself. He didn't want to have a house that he owed anything. So he was going to build it himself, no matter how long it took. And he pulled it off. He managed to build that thing. It took a long time, but he built it himself in his spare time. And when he finally got to the point where there was something he couldn't do, I think he couldn't do all the electrical. He paid somebody to do that, but that was it. He took forever to build it, but he built it and ended up owning it free and clear. So we had that, and there was a Thompson family here, and the house next to the Thompson family was the Uzzle family. I think they, what are they? What is that tribe? They are. They're Black American and Mattaponi. I think that's the name of the tribe that they are. It was Mr. and Mrs. Uzzle. They actually were the first Muslims that I ever met in my life, because he followed Islam. I want to say he was a member of the Nation of Islam, actually. So that's where, that was actually where I first learned about the whole Yaqut story and the story of their story of creation, of how Allah split the moon from the earth. So I got exposed to a lot of different ideas just talking to them and his kids. And there's the green, you saw the greenhouse turning into there. That is my cousin on my father's side. They were Campbells. So that's the lady that sold candy to the neighborhood. And all those, there was just like three houses before you get to Rodak's house. Those weren't there. I was all trees at one point, but he ended up cutting those down before I moved, and moved different people in and rented those houses out to people. And there was another house that was there that was next to the Campbell house that was a more modern home, but I cannot remember the name of the family that lived there. But that was it. It was really very woodsy. If you ever want to do some digging, there was a wooden spoon factory that was across the street from that little block that burned down, I think, in 1976. I was there, I watched it burn. I was there when it burned. And I remember that because I got in trouble because I snuck out of house at night and went down. So I wanted to see it burn. I was like six. Yes, I got the belt for that one. But I wanted to see it burn. And it's funny because that's where I first heard the term, the adults talking about insurance money. So the locals thought the guy burned the factory down to get the insurance money. I asked my teacher the next day, what's the short? I was like, what are you talking about? Because she was asking why I was sleepy, too, because I was really tired. So I snuck out of the house because I was a weird kid. I wanted to see it burn. I got to see it burn, and I came back in the house. I got a spanking and went to bed and went to school the next day.
Well, how do you think being in a rural community, living among your family members, impacted you, your work ethic, your thinking about family, and, you know, your ambitions? How do you think that impacted you?
I would say, me personally, I learned that you have to work if you're going to get something. This is something I tell my son. I'm really trying to impart this to him. You cannot guarantee success in life. You cannot guarantee success in life. You can guarantee failure, and you can guarantee failure if you don't do anything. If you sit around and you don't do anything and you give up, you are not going to get anything. The world is not going to give it to you. They just aren't. But if you want to have a shot at whatever you want, you're going to have to go for it. And sometimes, even if you don't necessarily get what you want, the act of going after it is going to give you skills and experience that you can apply to something else, that you can apply to something else. Because I got to see a lot of people, because they didn't really have a lot, but they were very intelligent. Like my cousin Rodark, I talk about him a lot because he used to talk to me all the time. I didn't understand half of what he was saying when I was little, but as I got older, the light bulb would come on. This guy designed a non-toxic pesticide because he needed it to kill termites. So he did that, and he made his own little spray can because he took the time to take some old one and, you know, weld it and get it so that it would spray right and he could maneuver it like he wanted to. My uncle Bernard, he had these trucks that people say, oh, Bernard's trucks are breaking down again, but he subscribed to Better Homes and Gardens. They had some kind of engineering series or small engine repair series. He had every book from them, and he just studied the books, and he would practice on his vehicles and learn how to fix his vehicles. And I never really became mechanically inclined like them, but I learned how to troubleshoot, and I think that helps me with IT. Because my trade is testing. When it's testing, you have to troubleshoot, and you have to be able to analyze systems and look at different things. And that's something I've noticed from a lot of other IT people that I met that came from rural backgrounds. They come from, what do you do when the pump's not working? You do this. You learn to tinker and figure stuff out. So that's one thing that kind of frustrates me in the job market, is people go, do you have experience in this? Oh, well, you can't do it. No, that's not true. You can train me to do it, or you can put me in front of the problem and I can figure it out. I saw people, like when I saw, you know, like all these metaphors of you have to have a good foundation wherever you're building. I was there when they built the Toy Thompson house that was next door to us. I was there watching the men build the foundation. So I know what a foundation of something literal looks like. And I'd ask the question, well, what happens, you know, if it's not right? Well, if it's not right, it's going to fall, it's going to falter. And one time, they had me build a little tiny barbecue pit with no cement. We're going to let you build this yourself. This doesn't have a good foundation, and watch what happens. So I stacked the bricks, and then they kicked it over because it didn't have a good foundation. I mean, I wasn't upset. He was showing me this is what happens when you try to put something up too fast, and you don't take your time to put it up. See, that's literal. It's not an abstract.
I want you to repeat it when that truck leaves.
Okay.
Because I'm sure it's going to come
out. From where?
Foundation. Thank you.
Oh, okay. So I saw men building the foundation. I asked them how they know how to use all these tools. They said, well, you have to look at the tool and see what type of job you want it for. The tool is an extension of your hand. It's an extension of your body. And they had me look at the tools. And they showed me a shovel. So they had me take the shovel and then stick my hand in the ground. So a shovel is shaped like your hand. That's how come it comes into the ground. A rake is just like your fingers. That's why it goes like this. That's why you can rake stuff across the ground like that with the rake like you would with your hands. So I learned that certain tools do certain things. When you're talking about software, you have software tools, they have cyber security tools, virus removal tools. You have certain types of software applications that do certain things. That's in an electronic sense, but that's based on something physical. So actually, when I got into software, they had me become more mechanical, because I could relate it back to something that I saw, even though I was too little to actually use the stuff, because I'd have killed myself. I was like 5, 6. Be Lefty Washington or something. But anyway, like what I was saying about a foundation, so they let me put up this brick barbecue pit. It was a fake little pit. They let me put it up, and it would fall over, or when somebody could kick it over, boom, because it didn't have a good foundation. So I learned the physical concept of something has to have a good foundation for it to last, and if you put something up too fast, it's going to crumble when it's under pressure. And that applies to relationships, that applies to your morals, that applies to anything. You have to pace things at the right time and build it properly for it to last.
One more story before we were... Khabib, did you have some questions you wanted to ask him? You sure? I love that. I want to remember the story of your grandmother coming to this house. Mm-hmm. You having to take her upstairs. You have to carry... Tell them that story.
Well, she came over here and, you know, her legs weren't starting to work so well. She wanted to see the full state of the house. I'm like, you know, don't worry about it. You know, maybe I'll take a picture on my phone and I'll bring it down to you. No, I want to see it. So she crawling over to the steps. She started climbing up the steps herself. I was like, all right, fine. So I pick her up. We helped her up. I helped her through the house. She wanted to see all the rooms of the house. So I showed her all around the house. She was so happy. She was more excited about it than I was. She was just so psyched that one of her grandkids finally made it to a house like this. And then I sat her down in my favorite chair, and she just enjoyed it.
Tell us who she was to you, the homeowner of that other the first place.
No, she was my grandmother. I mean, she was the matriarch of the family. After her mother died, because she's the oldest of, I think it's 14 of them. She's the oldest of 14, so she was the oldest daughter. So she says she raised her brothers and sisters, that's what she would say. And then she raised her kids, and when she had children, she only had two. So she raised them, she raised her two kids, and then I'm guessing after my folks split up, my mother came to live with her. She ended up helping to raise the four of us, too. So one thing that really struck me about her, and she only had an eighth grade education, but she was very good at maximizing whatever she had. Like, I remember one time, I didn't know the significance of this. And she was in some kind of, I remember her being in an argument with somebody on the phone. And she just said, it doesn't sound right. So sometimes she'd have me look at a piece of paper that she had, or she'd look up something in a book, and I'd read it to her, and she said, now, what do you think that means? And I explained to her what I thought it meant, and she said, I thought so. And she'd go off by herself for a second and come back. Like, it was something with the medicine. She thought there was a bad side effect. So I read it to her, and I just said, well, this, I can't even remember exactly what I said, but this means this. And is that what you mean? So that's what that means. And she was able to arm herself, because she would go to, even if it was just her grandkids, she'd go to somebody else to research stuff that she felt like she didn't understand. But because she had the older brain, she knew how to apply it. But she just maximized what she had, even if it wasn't a lot. She'd do that with her cooking. They used to fix their own stuff around the house all the time. They just maximized what they had.
How old was she? Is she still alive?
No, she passed away. She lived until she was 99.
Do you know what year she was born?
I'm sorry, I forget.
But she lived through the Depression.
Yeah.
So I
those Depression stories, oh my God.
Well, I mean, people, that would be that maximizing, you know, making everything out of nothing.
Yeah.
You know? That would be that. I think that the resilience, do you think that had something to do with her resilience?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Absolutely. Oh my gosh. Because they would always have this thing of, you think that you're always going to have, and you may not always have. See? You don't know, son. I'm just like, okay, I don't know. I'm sorry. I expect water to come when I turn on the sink. You know? But the improvisation is a definite must for them. Yeah. But the Depression, because they used to talk about how during the Depression, this is when they were living in it. I think they had to be on the Accokeek to Charles County border then. They said people would come through the woods looking for food. And since they were still associated with the farm, they had some food and they would feed people. They'd give them just a potato, or anything they could, because it was people coming from the city that couldn't eat. There's one man, I call him this one strange white man because I never saw him before. What year was I in? I started at Bowie, and I was on a reserve weekend. I was in the Marine Reserves. So I was sitting out there, I was in uniform, I was waiting for my grandmother, mother to pick me up where I got dropped off. Because one of the other Marines had dropped me off, and they were gonna come pick me up out by this McDonald's. This man stops, drives over there, and sits, runs out of his car and sits next to me. I never seen this guy before in my life. He says, I know you, and you don't know me, but I know you, and I know you, because I know you're that woman's grandson. I know you are. You look just like her. You're that woman's grandson that used to feed me. Your grandmother feed me. She saved my life. He was going on and on and on about the same stuff. He was talking about how there wasn't any food and stuff like that. Now, it could have been my maternal grandmother, or it could have been my paternal grandmother, because people say I look like either one of them, but they both said they did the same thing because they lived in the same area. He said that, you know, he'd have died if he didn't get fed, and they kept him alive, and he said he wanted to pay her back. I said it with me. Excuse me. And when they came to pick me up, he was just overjoyed and just said, thank you, thank you. And the funny thing is, they left, they were like, child, I don't know who that was. It was so many people that I fed, but I'm glad he was out here with you because he kept you company. Now, one thing I learned, let me get together. You can leave people money. But if you can leave a legacy of your deeds that you've done for people, it can echo far beyond you. So I'm pretty sure there's some favor sometimes I've been shown. It was because of stuff that people in my family, like her, did for other people. Maybe they couldn't repay them, but they could repay us. I don't know why that got to me like that.
Well, I mean, I think it's a good point. And if can we just, like, dig into that a little bit? That, like, connection to that land and that... helping people, mm-hmm. you know, and just being, just, you know, talk about that a little bit, your family and, you know, whether it was farm or whether it was garden or you know, be having that ability to share.
Well, part of that is hard for me to speak to because at the timing of my birth, I came right on the cusp of when all that was going away. Everything was starting to modernize. This is funny. I've told her this. Everybody's familiar with the Terminator. I call my cousin Fox Rodark the original John Connor, because the way that John Connor goes on about the machines are going to take over, that's how he used to go on. He used to talk like that. We were growing up because he said, look at me. He was going to say, look at me. Look at me. No, look at me, Grabby, look at me. You look at what I'm doing, you like what I'm doing, but you're not going to be able to do this. I said, why not? You're doing it. He said, because the machines are going to come and take over. Everything I'm doing with the land, they're going to take that away. He talked about they're going to have corporate farms. Because what he did, I think he only went to school to the sixth grade, but he read the newspaper every single day. He read the paper. He read like two or three newspapers. He always kept up with what was going on, and he felt like he could predict trends. So he told me, he was one of the first people that told me to go into the computer. He said, all the connections that we have to the land are going to go. They're going to have machines building houses, they're going to have machines preparing our food, you have machines doing everything. It's going to remove all the people from the land. The machines are going to come and just take everything. I'm just like, all right. So when I saw the Terminator, I was like, they finally made a movie out of this guy. The machines are taking over. But again, just when you plant, because I didn't get to plant as much as my other three siblings did, because when I started to get old enough to do it, the people that were watching me were getting old. They didn't have the energy and the stamina to do it anymore. They started trying to get vegetables out of the store. I'm probably one of the last ones, unless it was their hobby to go out and hunt and skin stuff. I learned how to skin an animal. My kids don't really know how to skin an animal. I've told them about it. I told them how to do it, showed them once. I learned how to scale a fish, how to take the skin off of a rabbit and eat it. Deer. How do we act? How do we act whenever we see somebody hits a deer? What do I want to do?
Yeah.
Tell him.
He wants to take it home.
I think,
and he expects me to cook it, but that's not.
That's never
happen.
Never happened. To me, like, that's something that you eat. A deer is not, oh, look at that wonderful deer prancing across the road. Like, for, you know, most people, it's, that's food.
Yeah.
That's something that you would eat. But by the time I came along, because I got to see that up till I was about 10, and people start doing it. And they went to the, they started going to the store to get stuff. But I'm telling you, not all the food in the store, but some of it is not the same. Like, because I grew up on well water, I don't feel it happening now in PG County. But the first time I remember going into PG, it was really going back to PG County, because I grew up in Accokeek till I was 4. And people had chlorine water. That stuff gave me a headache. I couldn't drink it. I thought it was nasty. It felt like I was drinking water out of a swimming pool. I couldn't tolerate the chlorine because I was used to well water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It smelled. Their houses, I know they probably thought that their house was so much better than mine, because mine was a little country home and theirs was pretty. But I would get headaches when they turn on the water because it had that chemicals in it. I'm guessing they fixed that now because I don't have that effect, but it felt like, that's probably why I liked science fiction so much. I felt like I was going into a sterile alien environment.
Right. Or your tolerance is just higher now. But you know, you tolerate, you get used to things. But what we want to do, you press some really interesting points, because what we're doing, what we have a reflexive way of doing is kind of seeing from our childhood and how it connects to the future,
mm-hmm.
through us and where it's going. And what we, but what we're doing, we're almost reversing. We're almost trying to see from here back into your childhood and how it connects to the past.
Mm-hmm.
That's so when I talk about that farm and, you know, that feeding of people,
mm-hmm.
right? And that communal energy, like that is what I'm trying to get an understanding of how your family connected to that communal energy. And it sounds to me like there was a nurturing of community,
mm-hmm.
that made it safe for somebody to come out of the woods and get a potato.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just, you know, wanting to hear that story,
mm-hmm.
or how that could possibly even be have happened.
Mm-hmm.
Could be because she looked at the tree.
What was the communal energy that you felt in that neighborhood? That as soon as we drove up, didn't
mm-hmm.
it feel like it? It felt very different. And then when we walked to the car and you said, "This was my cousin. This is my grandmother." That explained what we were feeling, but it felt immediately as we made that turn,
mm-hmm.
we were going into something that didn't exist here necessarily. You know what I mean? Like,
and
this is beautiful.
Yeah.
But it was a different kind of feeling.
Right. We are feeling it. It's so we felt it so deeply.
Yeah.
Right? And then when you made a few introductions, it made sense.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the part that I want to unpack and have you talk about. Like, why did we feel that? What was it that we were feeling?
Right? You hit on it, but she wants you to kind of put it in a circle.
Well, I can't really say. I mean, I think one thing that you're feeling, as opposed to this environment and that environment, is that there actually is an environment. I've always felt like concrete blocks the energy of the earth. You don't feel the connection to the earth when you're walking on this. That was one thing, the first time I remember going into DC that I didn't like. I used to rap in a rap band, and one of the songs I wrote was called Gray Buildings. And I had a line in the song that said, I've been walking on these here streets until I'm hard like the stone under my feet. And I was kind-hearted until the killing of my yen by the sinister gray buildings. I think a hard environment can breed hard people, can just disconnect you from nature. If you want to, like around here, if I wanted to feel sort of like where I felt going in there, I'm going to have to go further down to the park and get more surrounded by trees. If you notice too, the temperature in that little area is very cool. It's nice. It's a nice breeze because they actually have trees that are close together, and it's the trees that are supposed to be there. Right. It's the actual ecosystem. Right. It's not this transplanted from someplace and that transplanted from someplace to a forced geometric pattern. The patterns that emerge are natural.
What was it that you were feeling? So, you know, we know that DC has, it's the concrete, it's the transplanted trees, that, you know, it is that those things that diminish the yin, so you become aggressive with the yang boosts up.
Mm-hmm.
But what was it in that environment of your childhood that nurtured the yin?
Nature. Well, yeah, nature, and just because there's people that you know them. And they're on a different mission. They just want to live and to exist and to just be. Where in a metropolitan area, people are more on their goals and their drive. And a lot of times, you notice how in near most cities, everybody's not from there. They're from somewhere else. So I think that may have something to do with it too. I mean, it wasn't all idealistic roses and fairy drops and stuff like that, but I think it makes a difference when it's people that are there, that are from there, and they feel like that's theirs and like they belong. I think it makes a difference.
Was there a community midwife?
Not that I know of.
Was there a community doctor?
No. We went to a doctor up in PG County. But see, like I said, by the time I came along, I'm like right at the end. I got to see 2 to possibly 3 different worlds or cultures transition. Just because of the timing of my birth. Being born in 1970, I mean, I remember when a lot of stuff wasn't there and when it appeared.
When we were, Khabib and I last year worked on this project, which this is an extension. And what struck me was we had this thing about the term sharecropper. And we re-envisioned it, I believe, because we actually saw what it meant. And it was a pejorative for so many years. But we watched these guys, the Arabers, you know, the guys with the horse, they would get food, they sold food on the streets of Baltimore. They actually did it in D.C. as well. They called them something else. But they weren't just selling food, they were actually feeding a community. One of the people that was interviewed in this project, his daughter said her father would not come home if he knew that somebody on his block was, you know, on his route was hungry.
Mm-hmm.
That person was going to get fed. And that's what we're hearing. That's mm-hmm. what we're, you know, we know it wasn't roses, but what we're hearing is this sense of communal responsibility that you sprung from. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So like you were saying, the legacy of your grandmother may not have been that you were farming or that she was, or that your grandfather was a horseman anymore. But what the legacy was, what was the legacy? It seems like you are the epitome of that, you know, in your behavior and also the opportunities. Like, you got to go to school because they were working at the school, right? Mm-hmm. So there's always giving happening for your life. Can you see what we're talking about?
Yeah, but I can't. I shouldn't say I can't, because I guess I could if I chose to.
Yeah.
But I don't give in that way. The way I give now is just teaching the martial arts classes at the community center. And I just help people whenever I can. Because it just seems like that's what you should do. That's what you're supposed to do. If there's any major difference I would say I see in types of people, is a lot of people now, it's like they just don't seem to think that they're supposed to help anybody do anything. Like, they just appeared with all this information that they have, and like they didn't get it from somewhere. Like, if you go on a job now, they don't want to train people. Every job posting that you look at asks for experience, which is ridiculous. How is somebody going to get experience if nobody's ever shown them the way, like they were shown the way? You have to show people the way. And you know, in terms of tools, like with Taekwondo, every strike, every movement, even in Judo, every throw is a particular tool, and you learn how to use it. I first learned that you can use tools to manipulate the ground, to bang a nail into a wall. Then I eventually learned that you can use it, it's your pen that you write with, it's a tool, a book is a tool to get information. You don't have to have all the answers out in front of you. But if you have the ingenuity to look, figure things out, you can find the answers. So, I think because of the circumstances and timing of my birth, I saw it in a literal sense in the physical world. I saw it in the technological, electronic world, but I also feel that with community. That, you know, you don't need a committee to do it. You can choose to do it yourself. You can be the acorn that just starts growing something. And as long as you keep that water going, you don't know what that could grow into. But you got to start with a little acorn and just do your part. You don't, because I remember this, the stuff I told you about that whole thing with the AP classes.
Yeah.
I didn't understand the significance of that. But I just did what I was instructed to do, and it ended up making a difference. But that's the type of thing that I think we all need to do. And I feel like, because the world is becoming so, I guess Fox was right, I shouldn't have thought he was so crazy. The machines are taking over, but the machines are taking over in here. And there's another guy, I cannot remember his name. Remember Hakeem? He had the bookstore next to him?
Oh, yes, I do remember.
Hakeem, he had a bookstore in Oxon Hill. I cannot remember what branch of Islam he was in. One of his customers used to come in there. He had written a book, and he would talk about, his book was about automatons and machine people. And he would talk to me about that. He would tell me that, so you need to be aware of people who are soulless. They're coming into this world, and there's more of them. He was talking this back in, this was like, what, like early 2000s, late 90s. He said he felt like there was going to be a crop of people coming into the world that there was almost like they were robots, they have no soul. If you look at how a lot of people are starting to behave more and more in society, we're losing our soul. We're really losing our ability to care about other people. It's starting to affect me sometimes. It's like, because I'm in the environment, I started to pick up on that vibration. But usually something happens, always happens to knock me away from the vibration. I guess that's God. I'm glad, though. It'll knock me out of that vibration so that I don't adopt it to pick it up. But I think back in my childhood, there was this sense of we all are doing this, everybody's doing this. Like, no matter how much money people had or didn't have, you know, everybody has their little petty competitions or little squabbles or whatever. But when it came down to it, when push came to shove, you brush that aside, you address the situation, and, you know, everybody helps the community, you know, somebody gets help. Yeah. Now, from what I see in the larger society, we're becoming more and more extremely Darwinian, and people just think it's okay.
So I think his foundation of kindness came from his grandmother and mother just giving to other people and always being in the church and working for the church, and just they did all kinds of things to help other people. So I think he inherited the kindness from his grandparents.
Well, definitely from my grandmother.
Yeah. So just because of, and I think that was a sense of community that his mother and grandmother had, was to help other people. Yeah. And they did it through the church or just, you know, being able to feed somebody who needed food. And I think that's really affected him. He's in a big way that he's just always been a very kind person without being told to be kind. And I don't think he had to be told, because I think it was just part of his foundation in growing up. So,
one thing I think that made a difference too, I keep going back to the circumstances of my birth, just the timing, because I think timing is everything a lot of times. See, they were all in their 50s and older by the time I was born. That's a more mature outlook. 50-year-old is going to respond to a child different than a 20, 30, 40-year-old is going to. That's when a lot of people seem like they really get into their peak of it. They start coming into the peak of their wisdom. So it's like my frame of reference that I got in my blueprint was from older people that knew enough to look at a whole life cycle or like two generations. They've been around so long, they would know the significance of, let's take something simple as, okay, if I knock that over and they don't correct me on it, they know what type of person I would become. Because they're 50, 60, 70 years old. They know he's gonna learn to be destructive, and we don't stop him right now and say, hey, I know it doesn't seem important now, but this is the significance of it. Respect nature so that you will respect other people.
I have a question. So you also, so kind people, but building people. So you witnessed your family building and putting things together, and that, you know, inspired and set your the purpose of innovation,
mm-hmm,
a fire in you. I'm wondering about makers and creatives. Can you think about, do you have people in your family or in your community growing up who were artists or makers or creatives or,
yeah,
you know, sold their own clothes, made their own,
yeah, oh yeah,
quilts? And,
yeah,
you know, can, you know, because I hear you talk about building houses, and that's certainly a creative endeavor,
mm-hmm,
right? An artistic endeavor, too. What about other things?
Well, my mother could draw pretty well, and she could write poetry. She just never made a living at it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I read some of her poetry. I found out that on my father's side, it's a shame I didn't hear it until their funeral. They read some of the poetry that my paternal grandmother and grandfather wrote to each other.
Oh.
That was some of the most beautiful stuff I have ever heard in my life. I want to put it in a book, but they're like, that's the poetry. I'm gonna get my hands on that someday. Maybe they lower their guard down. And it was funny because I think they divorced when they were older, but they still kept an eye on the children. It's funny how when you know, watching them from a child's lens, I just see this old man that comes by the house and fixes stuff, and he may, you know, give me some advice, he may give me a spanking or something. And that's the old lady that she cooks for us, you know, and she's always telling us what we're not allowed to do, you know, because you got to rein a child in. So I can't do this, I can't do that. But by the time they passed away, first of all, because they both died within a year of each other, and they found their way back to each other in their old age, I would really like to get to the bottom of that story. I think that would make a nice movie. How they went apart, but they came back together, and it was always there for their children.
But also, this is what he's not telling you, is he's the third generation of that kind of literature. He's a writer himself.
No, I played the trombone.
Trombone.
Played the trombone, tuba. I can use the piano for composition. I've played jazz, reggae, ska, classical music, and I was in a hip hop band. I was the front teller for a hip hop band. I wrote songs for that and put some of that stuff out there. We made a little. I made some money with it. The hip hop money helped to feed my firstborn, and the science fiction books that I wrote. Pretty much, I didn't make a lot of money off it. I spent that all on my second born, feeding her. So yeah, but my father can sing. He's got a very, very rich baritone voice, like a James Earl Jones type voice. So everybody said when he was young he could sing, but he eventually got tired of it when he got a job for Metro. He could sing and draw. My mother could draw. Yeah, he played. He was a trombone player too. And who else? My grandmother could stitch any type of pattern that she wanted, and she had her own quilts and stuff that she made that were really nice. She could, I don't have any of those blankets, maybe my sisters may have one of those. So she could do that. My brother is really, 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 really funny. He is really funny. I've been telling him for years he should do stand-up. I think he's going to, he is like Eddie Murphy. He's really funny. My father is really, really funny. My daughter is actually pretty funny too, but she doesn't want to do it. Some of our other cousins, like the Joneses, they are all musical. When we go over their house, Joe had a band. He played the bongos and could sing, and some of his friends would be there. In addition to making some of the best fried fish that a man, and they grow stuff in their garden behind their house. Some of the best fried fish and stuff from out the garden you could ever have. You remember Shirley's fish?
Oh yes. Yes. Look forward to those yes. holiday
they
parties.
They can sing. They can sing. They sang really, really, really good. And his son also raps. He's got a really good voice too. So we definitely got some creative people. It just wasn't their primary living. But I mean, you know. To hear really good music, hear people sing, that was nothing. Oh, we also got people in the family that are martial arts too. So I thought I was doing something different. Nope. I'm third generation with that. Because Maurice, the grandmaster, that's Nana's generation. No, and so I would be second generation in that I know of. And they said they said my father could box. So we got all kinds of talent in the DNA, floating around the family. A lot of my cousins and stuff like that are into the martial arts too. They said, I thought I was just into some of this stuff, but they're like, nah, man, because I don't really know a lot of my family. They're like, nah, we've been doing this for a long time, but where you been? It's like, yeah, it's like all those people that look like you see doing that stuff, those are your relatives.
Thank you. Renz, we're going to cut here and go to the church. Want to go to the church next? What's closest, Renz?
The church will be closer.
Okay, let's go.
Yeah, because that's... Yeah. I think we're going to run out of daylight.
What?
I think we're going to run out of daylight.
Daylight?
Yeah.
Well, we'll at least get to the show.
Yeah.
Well, this doesn't get... Well, I think it doesn't get dark till 8.
No?
In the summer? 8 something.
Yeah, but it's getting late, though. It's already after 6.
Oh, it is? Oh.
It's after 6 when you get to the church.
I forgot we...